The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujak, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
When you look around Milwaukee and see how the city's architecture has evolved over the last 20 years, you should pause for just a moment and realize that many of the best building projects here have in some way been touched by the Dean of UWM School of Architecture, Bob Greenstreet. Bob has led the City Planning Commission and now serves as Chair of City Development. Recently, a national organization recognized what we in Milwaukee have known for a long time. Bob is somebody special. The American Institute of Architects Topaz Medallion for Architecture Education was awarded recently to Bob, and Bob is our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Welcome. Welcome back, I should say, Bob. We've had you on as a regular over the last several years, but that was before you were bestowed with this honor, the Topaz Medallion. Congratulations.
Thank you, Tom.
How does it feel to really be recognized at that pinnacle in your profession for educating that next generation of architects?
Well, it was something of a shock when I got the call, but a very welcome one. The American Institute of Architects and the Association of Collegiate School of Architecture, which runs the 150 schools in the United States, collaborate each year to choose one individual who receives the Topaz Medallion. And the competition is quite fierce. People like Michael Graves, Marcel Breuer have been winners in the past few years. And so it was very gratifying to receive the 38th medallion.
And you will actually be receiving it later this year, right?
Yes, I'll be in Denver in June to receive the hardware.
Well, the whole notion of the industry recognizing the people who teach their fellow professionals is fascinating, because yours is an industry, a profession sometimes I think not unappreciated, but perhaps unrecognized, because when buildings go up, we often, I think, take for granted the fact that drawings are made, designs are dreamed up, and suddenly the building appears. But we don't often see the architect. We see the cranes. We see the name of the construction company. But none of that would be possible if it weren't people like you who are having that vision or that dream in the first place.
Well, that's certainly true, although fortunately we have a sufficiently strong ego in our profession that we can sustain the lack of interest and the indifference. the job of architecture, and one of the things that makes the award so gratifying, is the fact that architects do something very different from other professions, which is they change the world. I mean, that sounds megalomaniacal. As I said, we do have ego. But the things that we do, my colleagues do primarily, is to shape the environment for our current generation, future generations. And so if architects do their jobs well, they make the world better. They change the quality of life. And if they do it badly, they hurt it. So responsibility is very high, but the gratification of seeing work being used by people, or people enjoying it, people's lives being made better by it, is a terrific feeling. It's a great profession.
You've been doing this for a while. How have you seen architecture evolve over the last few decades?
Well, obviously we go through style changes in architecture. Technology has brought a revolution in the way in which architects work through the computer. But the fundamental principles of understanding space and form and pulling them together into recognizable and enjoyable pieces and then transferring the style bits into human usage is not really changed very much at all. The profession has obviously just gone through a fairly tough period with the recession. We're recovering strongly. My colleagues in the architectural profession are looking much happier and are reporting that work is really picking up, most importantly for us, because we generate the next generations of men and women who are going to be architects and planners. Employment is very good. In the last graduating class in the summer, which was our largest ever, we placed 80 to 90% of our graduates from the professional program within 4 months of graduation. And the fall crop looks to be being placed even faster. So that's very good, and we like to see our students in good employment. But it also means that that's a good acid test that the profession is picking up, and therefore we'll be seeing cranes on the skyline again pretty soon.
You talk about the ways in which design evolves. There are styles. There are, I don't want to use the word fad, but there is different types of architecture that comes in fashion at times, and then sometimes fades. And I'm thinking of some of the worst examples, for example, on university campuses, not just here in Milwaukee, but around the country back, in the 60s, early 70s, I think they had something called the brutalistic form of architecture, where they threw up big buildings with concrete and blocks and almost impenetrable. What made that go away, and could anything dreadful like that ever come back again?
Yeah, I think we realized something was deeply wrong when they called the movement the New Brutalism. I mean, it didn't have a kind of a soft and fuzzy feel.
You can't
to
imagine
it.
People sitting around saying, "I have an idea.
Yeah,
let's be brutal with our next building."
It was an attempt to use new materials in crisp, clean, functional ways. And it was a little bit too honest for the way in which people like to live. Obviously, we have a couple of glorious examples on our own campus that I won't bother to mention. But brutalism, I think, went the way of other styles simply because people realized it really was. The public reaction was not a good one. Corbusier once said, "Life is right, the architect is wrong," when he found people had been putting pitch roofs on his flat roof buildings and generally making them much more livable. And I think public taste plays a considerable role in the development of design ideas. And after brutalism, we moved into postmodernism, which was much lighter, which was much more humorous and ironic, and to some degree intellectually less rigorous. But then beyond that, we're seeing a great more use of technology. We're seeing a lot of sustainable design coming in now. Sustainable design really is just good design because it's making the best use of materials and the best use of energy and trying to reduce waste, energy loss, and energy use wherever possible. So we're seeing some good examples of good architecture that are coming now. But it evolves. New ideas are moving along. The latest generation of students, the millennial generation, are very interested in how things are put together. Fascinating. We assume that with the role of the computer, that they will become more remote from the realities of construction. And certainly their computer skills are way beyond anything that my generation can understand. They're hardwired to technology. When they graduate, they're incredibly useful with what they can do because they work for my generation who are still clutching pencils. But they have also really immersed themselves in the hands-on details of how things go together. They like getting messy. And they like nailing things together. The little environmental center down in the Menominee Valley, which won a design award, has been internationally published, was a student design build project because the students really wanted to know how things get built, and they wanted to do the building. So it's a fascinating generation.
So the notion of an architect doing the design and then wiping their hands and saying, "Here it is, I'm done with this," that no longer is necessarily going to be the way that buildings are built in the future. You see architects more intimately connected to the construction process?
Well, we're seeing that in the architects will never be the full partners in the construction process. They're still, their expertise is very much in the design. But with the new building information modeling, BIM technology, you may have heard of the Revit as a program. Architects and contractors are working together right from the start to make sure that what architects design can be built by contractors, and they're working in partnership. Now, that's mostly larger buildings right now, but the technology is driving the process, which is really interesting because at the end of the day, a building is a collaborative activity. It shouldn't be combative with the architect overseeing the contractor there. They're both fellow professionals. They should work together in that. So we are seeing that. I think with what I'm seeing with the students is that they are they're using their education to go into different fields, not just traditional architecture. Now, traditional architecture and planning are absorbing them right now, but there are a number of them. A couple worked on the Marcus Prize studio last year. They've gone off to work with another Marcus Prize winner in Germany because they want to design build. That's their future. Groups like Design Fugitives here in town are using their architectural education to create different forms of exhibition design, furniture design, materials design, all kinds of interesting work, filmmaking, website creation. They're using their education in very many ways beyond traditional architecture because they like to do different things. And that's good. People with a design education can bring richness to any aspect of the physical environment. And to a great extent, our undergraduate education is really a problem-solving degree rather than a design degree. Architects are pretty useful people.
When you consider the role of the computer, you mentioned ways in which it's making design easier or perhaps a more complete process, connecting the vision with the people who actually are going to be pouring the concrete or whatever. I get that. Computers have touched everything and have changed the way in which we approach life, I suppose. What about the materials themselves? I've read recently that there are some incredible things coming down the road in terms of new lightweight materials, new alloys that can be bent or allow you to bend the shape of buildings or tools and the like in ways we might not have imagined before. Is that going to be something that you can teach today's students to be ready to deal with as new materials come online?
Well, obviously the schools of architecture are the place where you try and explore with innovation before the practicalities of practice set in with cost and client controls and legal requirements. So we try wherever we can to be aware of new innovations that are coming online. And as you say, there are some terrific new materials that are being developed. Many of them are very much in the sustainability realm, and they can help you create better buildings faster, more economically, and ones that will run faster, run more economically over their lifespan. One thing we found very useful is when we team up with industry. The reasons that I found the Topaz Medallion so rewarding was that it's a collaborative degree between the profession and education, and we don't always get on. We work very hard at UWM to create relationships not just with the profession but with the building industry. And so we'll work with them. We'll team teach with them. We work with Epstein Ewan architects on a Revit studio. Those students learn to do the best designs using the most advanced computer technology. They win national awards for that. They've won. We've won three. It's called NCARB. It's the certification group of the United States. They offer a prize each year. We've won it 3 out of 4 years for the work in the studios. The Spanshcrete studio, we work directly with engineers who use precast concrete, and our students design great buildings with the help of their engineers. I think we've won the Precast Concrete Institute of America's first place. I think it's 6 years running now. I mean, they're wonderful partnerships because we're getting out of the ivory tower, and we are working directly with the profession and with industry in a partnership, in a win-win partnership. And our partners love it. They get to be a little different, and they get to train new generations of students. And our students get an enormous amount from that. So it's the part of the role of the school to be relevant. I think we're very relevant to the city here in the role that we have with the city and the buildings that you mentioned. But we're also relevant to the makers of the physical environment. That's where we want to be. We want to be in the heart of things affecting decision making.
And that's so important, given the fact that your school is the only school of its kind in the state of Wisconsin.
The only and the best, yeah.
It is only the best, and in fact, one of the best, not just here in the Midwest, but beyond, given the awards.
Yeah, some recent rankings look good. Our PhD was ranked third in the country. We were ranked sixth among employees in the Midwest. I mean, the rankings are usually pretty good for us, so...
Well, and I don't know if you'll do it, but we'll give you some of the credit for ensuring the quality that is there. You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio, Bob Greenstreet. Bob is the dean of the School of Architecture at UWM and also the very, very recent recipient of a national award for excellence in architecture education, an award coming from the American Institute of Architects. But that's not the only award that Bob has won this year. He is also... as we tape this, getting ready to head off to London to receive a special prize there, the Freedom of the City of London Award. Tell us about that, Bob.
This is slightly less important, I have to say. And I attribute my father to this because he was also a freeman of the city. And the English tend to pass things on to the next generation of reprobates. You know, it's a kind of a tradition. So it's a ceremony that dates back to the 1300s of freedom. Sir Michael Caine was awarded it last week, I think. And it has purely ceremonial functions. For example, I am allowed to, if I should ever have to be hung, I will be hung with a silk rope, not a hemp rope. And I have the right to herd sheep across Westminster Bridge. So really important things like that. I figured I wouldn't do that. I thought I'd carry a pack of lamb chops over instead, you know, ease into it gently.
Although it sounds like you could throw a heck of a party with this stripe on your shoulder.
Well, the nice thing is that we're going over with a group of senior UWM alums for a behind-the-scenes tour of London and Paris. And they're going to come with me to the Guildhall, which is a 14th-century building, and they will see the ceremony, which will probably look like a lot of rejects from a Harry Potter movie wandering around in robes. So they've expressed an interest to come along, so we should have some fun with it.
Well, then, of course, this does connect to your heritage. You were born in England. Educated in England, what your undergraduate all the way through doctorate degree in,
that's correct,
in
yeah.
London?
Yeah.
At Oxford.
At Oxford Brookes, yeah.
Yeah. And so remind us, when did you make that break to the U.S.? What was it that brought you to these shores where you've done such good work over the years?
My wife Karen and I came over in 1981 to UWM. We decided to stay a couple of years before we moved on. And 30 years later, we haven't frankly found a good reason to leave. This is a very easy place to stay and a very supportive place. Terrific quality of life, wonderful students, great colleagues at the university. I mean, there's really not been a time when we've thought about leaving Milwaukee.
Well, and the fact that you have stayed perhaps led to another decision in the last year, and that is to hold dual citizenship. I understand you just became an American citizen.
That's right. Yeah, we both went through the process in the summer. It's lengthy, but very pleasant experience. The swearing-in ceremony was surprisingly moving. A wonderful judge who welcomed, I think there were people from 39 countries there, some of them in formal dress from their countries, which was a wonderful ceremony. So, yeah, we've committed to
it only took 30
States.
Years. But
well, we gave it 30 years. We figured we might as well give it another 30. Yeah.
And you can, as a British citizen, hold two passports, correct?
We are allowed to do that, yeah. Yeah.
So, and do you ever see yourself going back to live another part of your life in England, or do you see America as your permanent home now?
It's hard to say. I mean, we do go back from time to time. We still obviously have family there. But as I say, Milwaukee is a very hard city to leave. The quality of life is astoundingly high here and consistent over the years.
And yet, a city like Milwaukee, a lot of big cities, sometimes get a rap, you know, for having problems. You know, it's not perfect. There are issues there.
Sure.
Never dissuaded you from saying, I can do better?
No. As I say, the university is a big draw for me. We're at the point now where students will come up and say something like, my dad, my mom says hi. And, you know, I'll think, well, why would I know them? And they, well, you know, you were their professor. And frankly, references like that don't come any better than when people send their kids back to you for the next generation. So that's something that longevity in a role makes very special, this idea of generations of students coming through. And then you can tell them all about their mom and dad, which is great for ammunition. But you see change. You can make change. You can make change as an administrator. You can make change just as a citizen, and you can see your city and your campus grow. You know, when you and I came to UWM, it was still quite a young campus. My school was 10 years old. So taking it through puberty and seeing it evolve and change is a privilege.
And the faculty, you've also been blessed with a lot of wonderful people who are helping you educate that next generation. Yeah. It's not just Bob Greenstreet,
although
you deserve great credit for your leadership.
No, I'm just at the back of the herd. We have terrific faculty at UWM. We're very interesting. We're in a state of transition right now. Many of us came in the 80s, and the group of who set the school up in the 70s are in retirement mode. And so I'm seeing a lot of my senior colleagues now moving to a different level of service. You know, they are remaining connected to the school, but they're moving to retirement. So we're hiring in the next generation right now. I'll be making an offer hopefully this afternoon to a very talented couple of individuals. So watching that transition take place, making that transition work, it's like, you know, rebuilding a team. You've got to put the players together and look at the chemistry, and the new generation have very different views on the future than my generation, and I think that's appropriate. And so our job is to hire them, to enable them to succeed, and to, frankly, enable them to ultimately displace us.
Where are they coming from, all over?
Yeah. last year, we hired two wonderful faculty, both with degrees from Princeton. One who got his undergraduate degree with us, so he's a Wisconsin boy coming home. But just, you know, young, smart as all get out, and really helping to contribute to the future of the program.
Is it important for an architect educator to have worked in the field for a while, to have designed buildings or been involved in the development of places that might serve as a model that they could hold up to students? Or is it possible to come out with a great PhD degree and say, okay, I'm ready now to transfer or share that knowledge?
The answer is both, really. I mean, a faculty is composed of individuals who bring different skill sets. So you may have an outstanding academic that just brings his or her training just to the theoretical aspects of, say, history or theory, or someone who has terrific design capability, someone like Jim Shields, for example, whose buildings are dotted all over this city, who explore excellence through the design process. I want them both. The students benefit from that combination of professional experience, which is taking the path through to licensure, and also through academic depth, which is through the PhD training. And our profession has the advantage of bringing both. Now, we have one of the more skilled faculties, I think, that I know about in terms of the number of faculty that we have with PhDs, which is not a terminal degree in our field. And there are only 20 programs in the country that offer it. But also, probably 8 of the faculty have PhDs and architectural licenses. So it's a very high-powered group of individuals that we have up at the school there.
So I don't want to embarrass you, but I have to ask, if a job candidate comes in at the School of Architecture, do they get an advantage if they're wearing all black?
It helps, frankly.
This is radio, and so our listeners can't see Bob in the studio. But a little sidebar note on Bob Greenstreet is, not only is he a wonderful educator and a great dean, but he loves to wear black. In fact, I think I've only seen you in black.
You want to go to an architecture dean's convention? It looks like a group of sort of aging, slightly effeminate hitmen wandering around. It's just black everywhere.
What's the deal with it?
I think it's because we're afraid of color and commitment to color. That's what I've heard.
Really?
With me, I just
have
a very bad sense of
color.
You
look great in it. You know, you wear it well, but...
My color sense is not good, my wife tells me so. Dressing in the morning is very easy.
So it's not colorblind or...
No, it's bad taste.
I remember some people at the university I've seen, and I did call one out on it, they're colorblind and came in with two different sets of socks or two different... socks on from different sets. And they were sort of sheepish and saying, well, I guess I should have worn black today. So there may be something to say for that.
Sure.
Speaking of personal stuff, I understand that you celebrated another landmark recently in terms of graduating to a new chapter in your life. And you did something what sounds like absolutely crazy. You ran with the bulls in Spain.
I did do that, which pretty much my credibility shot. It was something that you hit a big birthday, you want to basically think back to your life. I've never done anything impulsive, rash, or incredibly stupid, and this seemed like a perfect opportunity to do it. So you really
got in the street. This is in Pamplona?
In Pamplona, yeah. It's a 13th century street pattern, and you're there with 2,000 of your closest friends. Hemingway's grandson was with the group I was with. He was Loy Down, and they released 12 extremely angry bulls, and they just run at you. But I trained beforehand. I hired bull runners to tell me how to do it properly, and I promised my wife I would not do it again. That was my one stupid thing.
Well, you are in great shape. I have to tell you, a couple of years ago, we started out walking together in the Panther Prowl, and I thought I was in pretty good shape because my wife and I walk a lot. And in a couple of minutes, where's Bob? So if you could beat us in the Panther Prowl, I'm sure you could outrun those bulls.
No, the bulls always win. They're doing 30 miles an hour. You'd run alongside them as far as you can, and then you get out of the way.
Okay, so what a year you've had. You've won this amazing award, the Topaz Award for Architecture Education. You're going to be in London to receive the Freedom of the City of London Award. You're a U.S. citizen within these last 12 months, and you ran with the bulls. What's the next chapter for Bob Greenstreet?
I certainly don't see it as the end of a chapter, but a pretty good beginning one. So I'm looking forward to the challenges of the next group of students, the next group of faculty, and the new changes we're going to see in Milwaukee. As this economy continues to recover, we'll see the cranes back, and we're going to see more building, and that's what excites everybody as the city grows.
Well, and you've said before on this program that some of the best work from architects come when they are older. I mean, not 30, but, beyond.
The architects tend to get their big projects when they get a little older. What I like to see at the moment, we have some terrific, well-established practices here in Milwaukee, but we're seeing a lot of younger practices. And, of course, they're all UWM grads. But these smaller practices that are doing smaller buildings but with tremendously high quality. And you're seeing probably 6 or 7 of these practices now that are really making a difference collectively. So it's an exciting time. And as I say, once things really open up, there's a lot of building that's going to be coming. It has to. Our population in this country is not shrinking. We're going to be needing a lot of good building. And certainly our school is ready to do our part.
Well, we thank you for all that you have done. And again, congratulations on the awards. And best of luck, Godspeed, as you move forward in that next chapter
Thank
of
you,
your
Tom.
Career.
Thank
Bob
you
Greenstreet,
much.
UWM's Dean of the School of Architecture and Urban Planning, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet the faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.